Today's show. More funding is desperately needed as Winnipeg's women's shelters are exceeding their capacity.
How do you turn someone away? Like, our shelter's a full, we can't add any more.
I would say, even conservatively, that we see someone who is experiencing domestic violence or gender-based violence in that way at least once a week, if not more.
A UNBC professor receives a $50,000 grant to create a women's cyber self-defense toolkit.
Keeping women and girls away from these social media and cyber platform will only disempower them.
The new Westminster Crisis Response Project wants to tackle homelessness, mental health, and substance abuse head on.
I've always heard that one of the, for someone who's unhoused, is that feeling of feeling invisible, sitting on a sidewalk and people just walking by and not noticing them. I want to see these individuals feel part of a community, feel connected to a community, feel valued, and have the ability to make a contribution.
Queens County fishermen head out early on dumping day, the first day of the lobster season.
Just the experience. Go out and make a living. You know what I mean? It's enjoyable. You got to be rough and tumble and just take it as it comes. Maybe hope for a good price and good weather, and the catches will come with it, hopefully.
And the Canada Post strike is affecting many Canadian businesses, including Pontiac's community newspapers.
We see newspapers closing all over the country. This is what's happening to newspapers right now.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Thanks for joining us this week. I'm Boris Chassagne, and I'll be with you for the next half hour and in good company with our journalists posted across the country. We first head out to Manitoba, where Winnipeg's women's shelters are in desperate need of funding as they frequently exceed their capacity. Domestic and gender-based violence remains pervasive and constant across the country and worldwide. The United Nations International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women reports, quote, that almost one in three women have been subjected to physical and or sexual intimate partner violence, non-partner sexual violence, or both at least once in their life. Close to 51,000 women were murdered by their partners or family members last year alone around the globe. End quote. Women's shelters are often the first point of entry of safety and support for these women, yet the demand for these spaces exceeds available resources. Shelters in Winnipeg frequently report operating at or above their capacity. Tsungai Muvingi Van Langendem, provincial coordinator for the Manitoba Association of Women's Shelters, explains that this surge has overwhelmed many shelters, forcing staff to make heartbreaking decisions about whom they can accommodate. Ryan Funk in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
Shelters across Canada and closer to home in Winnipeg frequently report operating at or above capacity. Since the COVID-19 pandemic, the frequency and severity of domestic violence has increased, with the surge overwhelming many shelters, forcing staff to make heartbreaking decisions about whom they can accommodate, says Tsungai Muvingi Van Langendem, provincial coordinator for the Manitoba Association of Women's Shelters.
Our shelters are operating consistently at or over capacity since the pandemic, which is something very challenging, because how do you turn someone away? We're like, our shelters are full. We can't add any, you know, any more.
One of the biggest challenges is accessibility in rural and remote areas, where transportation and internet access barriers make it harder for people to seek help. Despite these obstacles, shelters continue their vital work with dedicated but overburdened staff. North Point Douglas Women's Center in Winnipeg is an example of the impact a dedicated resource can have. Kalita Benedictson, manager of operations at North Point Douglas Women's Center, explains that the center provides everything from crisis intervention to long-term programs promoting healing and empowerment. Each of these programs is vital for the community, with Benedictson explaining, although rates of violence do fluctuate, it remains a constant.
I would say, even conservatively, that we see someone who is experiencing domestic violence or gender-based violence in that way at least once a week, if not more. We have people disclose once or twice a month, and then we will actually see an immediate emergency situation with like fresh injuries and things like that, probably once or twice a year. And that's too much.
This highlights the desperate need for these centers. as these situations can be incredibly traumatic and stressful.
Those times where people are quite literally like running to the door because they need a place to be safe, and then we're immediately locking it and clearing the space, those are challenging for everyone involved. And our biggest priority in those times is to sit with that person and to let them be in the driver's seat.
Despite staff efforts, shelters face significant challenges. Funding is often insufficient, and the housing crisis complicates matters. With limited affordable housing, many who experience violence have nowhere to go after leaving shelters. Addressing domestic and gender-based violence requires a multi-pronged approach. Governments must increase funding for shelter operations and prioritize legislation reforms that protect survivors. Investment in transportation services and mental health resources is vital for rural areas.
Many people don't recognize and understand that abuse can happen to anyone. It's not limited to one group or one community. It is unfortunately spread across community, both in urban settings and in rural settings. This issue is a community issue. It's not a behind closed doors problem.
Public education is equally essential. Awareness campaigns that dismantle harmful myths such as, why don't they just leave, can shift societal attitudes and empower people to seek help. Teaching youth about healthy relationships and respect can also break cycles of violence before they take root.
It's so vital to have these conversations and to bring awareness to it, because it can often hide in plain sight. Abuse by nature is about power. And when someone seeks power over another, they tend to isolate them. They present a different face to the rest of the world. So a lot of people are completely flabbergasted when they hear that someone has been through this situation with a partner that they also know. Any type of gender-based violence can take so many forms. It can be physical, it can be sexual, it can be emotional or psychological, it can be financial, and that goes towards the isolation piece as well.
I'm Ryan Funk.
The International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women also marked the launch of the UNITE campaign, which is held from November 25th to December 10th. UNITE is part of the United Nations program 16 Days of Activism, which concludes on the day that commemorates the International Human Rights Day on December 10th. Learn more about this on the United Nations website.
Do you have questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
So we stay on the subject of preventing violence against women and move to British Columbia, where UMNBC's Assistant Professor of Global International Studies, Dr. Luna Casey, secured a $50,000 MINDS grant to develop a cyber self-defense toolkit for women. The funding was given to her by the Department of National Defense. Her initiative addresses online gender-based violence, a critical issue that is often overlooked. Many victims don't know where to seek help. Victims often resort to deleting their online presence. Online harassment has affected women in Prince George, BC, and across the country. Dr. Casey tells Ian Gregg in Prince George that removing oneself from social media is not necessarily the best course of action.
Just deleting social media account or, you know, limiting the presence of women and girls online only disempower them, right? Because now, given that internet has so much of power to advance your career, like everything has been digitalized. So keeping women and girls away from these social media and cyber platform will only disempower them. So I think we need more, you know, rights and, you know, regulations for them to keep active. Yeah. Yeah. And I think also, you know, it's also difficult to prove that. And now, like, we are coming into that state that, you know, where people are, you know, people have started to realize that cyber violence or, you know, this tech facilitated violence has a real life consequences, right? And it's very difficult to, you know, make people understand that these violence exist. And in a time where even, you know, physical gender-based violence have not taken seriously, and then, you know, if you talk about cyber violence, then it's even more difficult to make people understand that this violence has a real consequences, or, you know, it can impact people in a physical violence, right? Because Otherwise, I know that some of my respondents have shared with me that there is no proper reporting mechanism for online violences, right? Because you really have to prove them. And how are you going to prove it, right? And there is also a very easy way to delete them or, you know, change the things, make it fake with this deepfake, you know, coming so rapidly around. So it's really difficult. So I hope that this toolkit, we are going to make some of these points clear to people who are facing this sort of challenges in their everyday life.
The issue of online cyber harassment is quite large. Mm-hmm. This is being looked at on a national level, perhaps even global. Is this really something that affects us in Prince George?
Oh, yeah, I think absolutely, because like we discussed, because, you know, this is not one place problem, right? It's like very widespread and, you know, it impacts everyone. And last time I was chatting with some of these women leaders or women who works on these shelters, women shelters, right? One of them were mentioning that, you know, most of this, you know, violence that have been reported and this women fleeing violence are starting from, you know, digitalization or from online violence. So either someone has texted them or maybe, you know, they became friends on Facebook. So most of this violence today are starting from online. And definitely, you know, this is something very much widespread. And obviously, you know, the cyber violence is also Prince George issues as well. Not only, you know, our central issue, but it is also very local issue as well. Yeah.
Developing a women's cyber defense toolkit would be an excellent resource for probably anyone directly or indirectly dealing with online harassment. You've touched on the layers of complexity in this issue, though, and it seems that a lot of research has to be undertaken in order to develop a helpful resource like this toolkit. While you are performing most of that research at the University of Northern British Columbia, are there opportunities for our local population to participate in that research or to inform some of the information that you're gathering for this Women's Cyber Defense Toolkit project?
Yeah, so in my last workshop that I held, this workshop was twofold. The morning session was basically, there were also people joining on online, you know, through in from Vancouver, Ottawa, you know, Toronto, and different regions. And then the second half was only in person. So majority of them were students and also people from local community, especially from Prince George. And so we discussed very interesting questions. And then all these, you know, the practical recommendations and the political recommendations, which this toolkit will build on, was based on very localized, you know, experiences, their everyday experiences, right? And also very evidence-based, because people were sharing their personal experiences, the experience of their neighborhood, and student as an, you know, youth, how do they, are they tackling everyday violence in their own context? So yeah, I think this is very much localized, actually. Yeah. In this toolkit, I'm also trying to highlight some issues around intersectional collaborations. Intersectional collaboration is not something just bringing people from diverse backgrounds just to fill the chair or something, or tokenized collaboration, but also, you know, really taking diverse perspectives seriously. So that's why I have a diverse group of people in my research team, and my respondents coming from women of color, black women, women coming from, you know, minority groups. So I'm really looking forward how the intersectional collaboration will help, you know, shape this toolkit.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrim, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints.
We stay out west and stop in the city of New Westminster, which is taking a novel approach to ongoing homelessness, substance abuse, and mental health crises. The New Westminster Crisis Response Pilot Project treats the three crises as related and intersecting instead of separate and distinct. With that in mind, the project developed compassionate, innovative, and goal-driven ways to address the issues through a trauma-informed and culturally appropriate approach. The project, which will continue for at least the next 21 months, focuses on both immediate short-term solutions such as sanitation trailers and proposed inhalation-focused safe consumption sites. This pilot project is designed to be responsive to data and community feedback. Details with Jesse Winsloff. He's in Burnaby, British Columbia.
The project, initially launched in September, is a new approach, based on lessons learned from wide-ranging research into existing literature and approaches taken by other municipalities around the world. Brad Davey is New Westminster's assistant fire chief.
The most unique part, I think, is our approach. One of the first things that we did is we looked at some of the literature that is out there. And as John has already said, we looked at all the other municipalities. We're not actually copying what anybody else has done. Instead, we're trying to cherry pick the approaches from the other different municipalities that are working. And then we have quite an active program involved to try to make sure that we engage everybody so that we can be an iterative in our approach and that we can adjust to identify any gap that's being missed or anything that we need to engage or to include anybody that could be affected by these crises, so that they have a voice to point us in the right direction if we need to improve anything.
The project is still in its infancy, having launched less than 3 months ago, and Davey and Stark recognize that solutions will not be immediate. Despite the long-term outlook, there are already some positive early results.
These types of changes, like we're talking about supportive housing, this is a two-year pilot project. Some of these changes will take 3 to 5 years longer, really for substantive change to be seen. So we have to show in that two-year period that we are making progress, that plans are in place. We've heard from businesses and residents that they want a vision. For some businesses, they're looking at potentially extending their leases. They want to know what the plan is for the city. So we're looking at that. A big part of that is relationship building with the senior levels of government, either for funding this pilot beyond the 2 years or addressing the needs and gaps related to the three crises. And we've had a lot of success. I mean, an initial piece of success was human waste is an issue in our city. Businesses and residents raise it on a pretty well daily basis. It's an issue in all municipalities. But we work with BC Housing. We now have a sanitation trailer, which offers toilets, sinks, and showers. It operates 24/7. It has attendant services, and BC Housing is covering the full cost of that. So that's been a plus, and we're starting to see some of the positive impacts with regards to a reduced amount of human waste and fewer complaints.
Getting residents and businesses on board will be essential to the project's success. So public engagement is a key focus, with plenty of feedback already gathered.
We've actually done more than one public engagement session. We've met on several occasions with the Downtown Residents Association, on several occasions with the Downtown Business Improvement Association. We had a joint session with the Downtown Business Improvement Association, the Chamber of Commerce, where we also reached out to faith-based and nonprofits. I will say with residents and businesses, there is kind of a wait and see, you know, wanting to see how the situation will improve and a lot of questions. But I will say, I think when the information is shared and they get a better understanding of the scope of the pilot and the fact that it's iterative and it is being independently evaluated and is based on best practices, I think if we can demonstrate that we're not only meeting the needs of the unhoused and those living with mental health and substance use issues, but businesses and residents as to some of the impacts they're experiencing, I think we'll definitely get more buy-in for the pilot. And we're hoping that businesses and residents will help us advocate for needed services and supports, including supportive housing. And part of that is being out in the community, answering questions, being accessible.
While there are questions about whether the city should be funding this project, which tackles issues that are typically the responsibilities of provincial and federal governments, and about the effectiveness of certain proposed solutions, Stark says that the crisis response pilot project arose from a need to take action instead of waiting for a perfect, fully funded solution from senior levels of government.
This will have positive impacts. It may take some time, but it will have positive impacts. And enforcement is also not a solution because it just moves the issue from one area to another. And the courts have stated that people are allowed to shelter overnight in public places. So we do have to look at longer term strategies. There are too many people right now who are unhoused, who are living with mental health and substance use issues. So my hope is that we do provide those facility services and supports so they can become either sheltered or housed, stabilize their lives, connect to services, and over a period of time, have the ability to be part of a community. And that's so important, that whole belonging, connecting. I've always heard that one of the, for someone who's unhoused, is that feeling of of feeling invisible, sitting on a sidewalk and people just walking by and not noticing them. I want to see these individuals feel part of a community, feel connected to a community, feel valued and have the ability to make a contribution. And I also realize being a social planner, because I'm going through two temporary use permits related to shelter proposals, is that the community better understands these issues, recognizes just how even childhood trauma can impact a person for the rest of their lives, and through providing supports and services that change can happen.
From New Westminster, Jesse Wensloff reporting.
Hi, this is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're tuned to Viewpoints.
Canadian companies have had a tough time recently struggling to adapt to the impact of the Canada Post labor dispute. Community newspapers are feeling the pinch as well, as many of them have not been distributed and printed since the strike began. In Pontiac, Quebec, two local newspapers are hoping their readers turn to their online editions to catch their local news. The strike has dealt a blow to many newspapers, large and small, across the country. Small local publications have been hit the hardest. According to the Local News Research Project, 525 local news outlets have closed in 347 communities across the country since 2008. 75% of those were community newspapers. Sophie Cooper-Dixon, the managing editor of The Equity, based in Shawville, said that they have been making the digital transition for some time now. The strike has hastened their efforts. Caleb Nickerson in Pontiac, Quebec.
Pontiac's two local newspapers have had their distribution heavily disrupted by the ongoing postal strike, but are hoping their readers turn to their online editions for their news. Roughly 55,000 unionized postal workers have been on strike since November 15th, including delivery drivers in the Pontiac. According to media reports, it's unclear when the negotiations between Canada Post and the union over issues including wages, benefits, and working conditions will be resolved. Sophie Kuiper-Dixon, the managing editor of The Equity, a weekly English broadsheet based in Shawville, said that they've been making the digital transition for some time by offering access to their online edition with their print subscriptions. She said that over the summer they invested in revamping their website and said that they had seen an uptick in the last week of people accessing their online accounts for the first time.
Obviously, we'd seen it coming. Like, for a week or two, there were sort of talks that Canada Post had voted in favor of a strike mandate, or the union representing the workers. And so we did in the paper before they actually walked off the job, we had a little notice saying, hey, this is likely going to be happening. Just kind of encouraging all of our subscribers to reach out and get their online account activated, because the online account is what makes it possible for people to just continue to read all of our content online for free. Like, if you're already a subscriber, you can access it all online.
Newspapers big and small across the country have long been struggling with the steady decline of print advertising revenue, though small local publications have been hit the hardest. According to the Local News Research Project, since 2008, 525 local news outlets closed in 347 communities across the country, with roughly three-quarters of those being community papers. The Pontiac Journal, a free biweekly bilingual tabloid based in Mansfield-et-Pontefract, has also been hit hard by the strike, as their paper is typically distributed to every mailbox in the Pontiac. Manager Lynn Lavery explained in an email that they are distributing their latest edition at various businesses and dépanneurs throughout the region, including CHIP 101.9's office. Their website is free to access and contains a list of all the physical locations to pick up a copy. The Equity has been in print since 1883, and Kuiper-Dixon is the third generation of her family leading the paper's newsroom. She said that the strike has been a wake-up call in terms of the challenges that print publications face in 2024.
We see newspapers closing all over the country. This is what's happening to newspapers right now. And somehow, incredibly, we still have two in the Pontiac, which is huge. We're proud that we've been around for 140 years, but part of what we're trying to do is shift into making our content available in a way that people can get more quickly and in places that's convenient to them. And when something like a postal strike happens, it is kind of this wake-up call just for me and saying, oh my goodness, like, this is what it would look like if our newspaper wasn't going out. I do feel like there's this moment sometimes when, oh, all of a sudden the newspaper isn't showing up at your door, that people sort of realize, oh, this is a service that's being provided and that isn't just guaranteed. Like, there's a lot that goes into making this paper show up at my door every week, whether it's the people writing the stories or The postal workers driving the newspaper to your doorstep. There are a lot of people involved in sort of making that information available and accessible. And this has just been a helpful reminder for me about that.
This is Caleb Nickerson with the Local Journalism Initiative.
And we close our show in Nova Scotia, where over 1,400 fishing vessels left their docks on November 26th to mark the start of the lobster fishing season in the southwestern part of the province. The season starts with what they call Dumping Day. That's when fishermen set their traps in some of North America's most lucrative lobster grounds. Despite a general decrease in catch volume in 2023, Nova Scotia managed to ship over $1.3 billion worth of lobsters abroad that year. So some 680 vessels from Queens County motored out at 7 a.m. Dozens of family and community members were standing at the Port Medway docks to wish fishermen a safe season. It wraps up at the end of May. Rick Conrad in Liverpool, Nova Scotia.
Hundreds of fishing boats left wharves early Tuesday morning all along the South Shore as lobster season got underway in southwestern Nova Scotia. Known as Dumping Day, it's the day that fishermen set their traps in some of North America's most lucrative lobster grounds. Queens County fishermen motored out at 7 a.m. Dumping Day was delayed by a day because of weather. Dozens of family and community members were at the wharf in Port Medway to wish fishermen a safe season. Here are some of the people and sounds from the morning.
John Conway, Caledonia. We were out yesterday and got the boat loaded, and we're hoping for some fine weather here to get set and catch some lobsters tonight. It's actually through some of my cousins out Sable way. I started going landing day and helping land traps, and it spiraled from that into fishing full-time. Just the experience. Go out and make a living. You know what I mean? It's enjoyable. You got to be rough and tumble and just take it as it comes. Maybe hope for a good price and good weather, and the catches will come with it, hopefully.
I'm Katerina Cochran. I'm the Vice President of the Chamber of Commerce, and we are out here every year to serve some coffee for our fishermen friends here. This is my third year at Port Medway, but we go into all of the ports. Well, we want to send them off for some good cheer and wish them a safe journey for the season to come.
Pincombe, and I'm from Mill Village, and I think we have been to just about every one of these dumping days for the last 17 years. Yep, we kind of come down every year and see them off, and it's just kind of something you do when you live here because it's fabulous.
My name is Ray Legere. I'm also from Mill Village, and Kathy's right. We've been here for, I guess, 17 years. We probably hit 15 of them anyway, and we just love to come down and see this part here and all the people on the wharf, but then we scoot right down to Medway Head Light. And the best part is when you see them all just sort of go out into the ocean and scatter as the sun rising. It's absolutely fabulous. And I can't miss it. It's just something we have to do every year.
I'm Rick Conrad.
And that is it for us this week. Thanks to our journalists, Ryan Funk, Caleb Nickerson, Rick Conrad, Jesse Wensloff, and Ian Craig. Our national editors are Victoria Fenner and Conrad Funks. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and, of course, your local radio station. Remember to catch all our stories on frequencynews.ca. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassagne. Happy to have you with us this week, and until the next, ciao.